For many of us, the natural beauty of Wisconsin is one of the best things about living here, and we're lucky to have so many wonderful native species to enjoy, but it doesn't take much to throw that ecosystem out of balance when invasive species arrive and start to take over. And our guests today work very hard to monitor and control the spread of invasive species in our state. And with June being Invasive Species Month, great time to talk about those efforts with Kelly Kearns, who is the Invasive Plant Coordinator with the Endangered Resources Program in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kelly, always great to have you with us.
Thank you.
And with us as well, Bernie Williams. Bernadette's an Invasive Species Specialist with Forest Health of the Wisconsin DNR. And Bernie, good to have you back on the program as well.
Oh, thank you.
Really appreciate having you here. Kelly, what are some of the most common invasive plants that we're worried about right now here in the state?
Well, most people are most aware of species like garlic mustard, buckthorn, honeysuckle, and those are pretty abundant statewide. We also have things like wild parsnip that everybody's starting to see in bloom right now around the roadsides, and spotted knapweed. So it really depends on what part of the state you're in. Fortunately, not all of these plants are abundant in throughout the state yet, and so in the areas where they're not yet abundant, we're trying to make sure people are aware of it and trying to get out new populations and stop them from spreading before they become as abundant as they are in other places.
And as you said, that parsnip is starting to flower right now. How would people recognize that right now as they drive around?
Tall, about 3 to 4 feet high, and big yellow flowers. It looks like a giant carrot with yellow flowers.
And they're all over the state?
They pretty much are at this point. There's a few parts that it's not as abundant, and certainly there's a number of roadsides that are not infested yet, but it tends to get spread along roadsides if they're mowed late in the season when there's seeds on the plants.
Yeah.
So we're working a lot right now with a lot of the county highway departments, especially to get them to mow early when the plant is still in the early flowering stage so that they don't spread the seed.
Yeah.
And that we're getting a lot of good cooperation from those highway departments.
Well, that's good to know. And in terms of detecting and monitoring them and obviously controlling them, you're working with the county folks. What other steps do you have?
Well, one of the things is just alerting people to this and educating people about why invasive plants are of concern, and let them know that these are things that they can stop if they catch them early, and they can really save themselves a lot of time and money if you catch a population before it starts to spread. And so that when there's new invasives starting to come into the state, then we try to get word out to people that this is something really to be aware of and watch for it. Let us know if you find it so that we can keep it from actually spreading throughout the state.
And Bernie, there are other invasives in Wisconsin besides plants, and one, you know, most people wouldn't think of it of them, but earthworms can be an invasive, and they aren't native to Wisconsin necessarily.
Right. So everybody thinks that I'm trying to give earthworms a bad name, but actually I really love worms. It's just keeping them in their proper place. So right now we have an ad campaign about disposing of your bait properly. Contain your crawlers. It's aimed at a lot of anglers, fishermen, anyone that, you know, is along the shoreline. Even if you're doing vermicomposting in your backyard, you can just contain them. Because the big misnomer is that earthworms are native to Wisconsin, but actually they're not. During the last glacier, all of our native earthworms were wiped out, and consequently all the earthworms that you're familiar with are actually from Europe and Asia. So,
and they cause problems, especially with our forest land.
Yeah, and that's the main problem. Again, like I always tell people, you know, I'm not on this campaign to smear worms. It's just if we can keep them out of our woods, they do have an effect on the regeneration, particularly in our northern hardwood stands and particularly on sugar maples. They eat the fallen leaves, which is the duff layer, and that's really important for all the regeneration of our trees and native species because it holds this mycorrhizome layer, which is this really important fungus that we need for regeneration. So it's just an awareness campaign.
We have Tom and Stoddard with a question for you, so let's go there. Tom, thank you for calling. Hello.
Good morning. I would like to ask two basic questions. The first one is, I have a new creeping plant that clings real close to the ground. It makes a dense mat. It gets growing really early in spring and before I can get in my garden and work. it's just really thick, and I went in there with the riding lawnmower to cut it, and it just plugged up the deck right away, and it's just amazing stuff, and we've never seen it before. It's infecting my brother's farm, too. And I have a rototiller, which I loaned to him. Maybe he infected me or I infected him. But I'm wondering if you know what this stuff is. It's it just only grows, well, it has long roots underneath the ground, but it only grows generally initially about an inch high, but then it keeps growing to be a thick mat about 4 to 5 inches high. The other question I have is I've got garlic mustard already going to seed and I haven't had a chance to get out there with my weed whacker, and I'm wondering if I could buy a torch and torch that stuff back into submission. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, let's take the garlic mustard question first. Yeah, if you have garlic mustard and you have not gotten it pulled yet, then you want to get that pulled because what you're trying to do is actually keep the seeds from dropping to the ground and germinating in future years. The plants that the garlic mustard plants that have gone to seed this year, they're dying. So there's no sense in trying to kill those plants. They're already dying. It's really the seeds you want to get off the landscape and get them bagged up and disposed of carefully. A torch may or may not be effective at this point. It would be a lot of work to try to hit all those seeds, and it may or may not kill all of them. So I think if you can, getting them pulled up is still probably an effective thing to do at this point, and like getting them immediately in a trash can or something. Hmm. And for plants like this one that you're describing, there's a lot of things that it could potentially be, and so it would be best if people, when they have an unknown, really weedy species like this, to either take a sample or get a photograph and send it in either to the DNR's Invasive Species Program or take it into your local extension office. And extension offices generally are pretty good about being able to identify these things. And if you can send it in a photograph, you can send it to invasive.species@wisconsin.gov, and we'll be able to figure it out for you. And when you do that, then always try to send in flowers are really great if you can have pictures with that, leaves, stems, everything you can to help to identify it. It really helps a lot.
Actually, if you had a picture of it now, a photo of it now, you could send it into our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we can post it and then have a look and see if we can figure out what it is.
Yep, that'd be great. And one thing that I do want to point out, he mentioned that it's possible that he actually transported this vine on his rototiller, and it's very likely that's what happened. It's one of the ways that people can accidentally transport weeds very easily. So it's part of one of the things we really try to encourage people to do is clean off your equipment. This is for construction equipment, boat equipment, anything that could potentially carry invasive species. We really want people to clean off that before they go somewhere else so that they're not spreading it.
All right. Thanks. And Tom, if you've got a photo, post it on my Facebook page, and we'll see if we can come up with an answer for you. And that goes for anybody else, too, for that matter. If you want to post a photo of a weed that you can't identify, we'll do our best to try and answer it. Thanks again for calling. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or again, go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there, and we'd love to hear from you. Bernie, I want to go back to you for just a minute because I'm wondering, I know there's been some significant research done in the West, Western United States, about earthworm invasions into forest land out there. Have we done any research, or is there any ongoing research here in Wisconsin of a similar vein?
We are starting that research. So I'm working in the Northern Highlands in Wisconsin, so that's one of our biggest state forests in the state. What we're trying to do is we're trying to isolate areas that we can find that are still earthworm-free. And they're very few and far between. So we have a lot of researchers actually out there and foresters this year that will be doing survey plots, just observing whether or not we do have intact duff layer. So that healthy layer of about 3 to 5 inches of leaf litter. And what species of trees are actually regenerating and which aren't. And so we see a lot of ironwood coming up. We see a lot of hazelnuts coming up. We see a lot of red maple coming up. And we see that the conifers can actually withstand huge amounts of earthworm invasion. But we're really having the problems with the sugar maple, which just happens to be the the state tree.
Yes.
And when you look at earthworms, they're pretty synonymous with all of the terrestrial invasive species. So when Kelly and I talk about garlic mustard, you're hard-pressed to ever find garlic mustard that doesn't have earthworms underneath, because earthworms, they deplete the soil, so it just opens it up for all the invasive species to come in, and then they make that monoculture underneath, and then to get any regeneration, it's very difficult. So you get those huge stands of buckthorn, honeysuckle, Japanese knotweed, and the list goes on and on. So that's why we work so closely together.
And there has been a great deal of research on this done through the University of Minnesota at Duluth. They're actually the ones that really initiated a lot of this a number of years ago.
Lee Frelick, Cindy Hale, the Minnesota Worm Watch, we partnership with them. They share their information. I share our information. So they're really ahead of the game.
I remember Scott Craven talking about going to a national convention out west. And, you know, this is some years back, and like the big conversation was the first, it was the, like the first paper published on the effect of earthworms in the forest, and it was like all these wildlife folks were really, really surprised.
Right.
Yeah. And you mentioned buckthorn. Jerry commented on our Facebook page, he'd been fighting it on the property for 15 years, still find new plants every year, feel like I'm losing the war.
Well, there's a couple of things that he may or may not be doing right. One is that when you cut buckthorn, it will resprout. It just will. And so if you really want to kill that root system, you have to use an herbicide that will actually be absorbed down into the root system and kill the root system. And that needs to be done in the fall or winter and with the proper herbicide at a cut stump treatment level. And you're also going to have seedlings that are going to come up. If it's been in the woods for a long time, there's been seeds and the birds are going to be bringing seeds in, they will be coming up as well. If it's like an oak-dominated woods, then fire is a really great system for knocking back those that buckthorn. Otherwise, just going in and hand-pulling, weed-whipping. Some people use herbicide or torches on those seedlings. It is a constant. You got to keep up on it all the time.
Talking today with Kelly Kearns and Bernie Williams of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, visiting with them today about invasive species. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Give a call. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we visit about invasives with Kelly Kearns and Bernie Williams from the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Kelly, I know there's always questions that I sometimes forget about and things I know that you want to emphasize. And is there something in particular today that you'd like to emphasize?
Well, this is Invasive Species Awareness Month, and we do that every June. And it's a way to try to encourage people to get out there, do some work on invasives, go to work parties, go learn more about it and get more involved. And we choose June because it's usually the month when a lot of things are starting to bloom, easy to identify. This year, everything was a little early, and so we could have done it earlier. But just want to mention a few of the things that happened on Invasive Species Awareness Month. We had a coloring contest this year, and we had about 300 students that submitted contest entries. And those entries are right now are all up in the state capitol on some display boards in the rotunda up through the end of this week. And so anybody who's in Madison who wants to see that can go see those great posters up there. We also have Invader Crusaders every year, and these are people who do extra hard work on invasive species. And one of the people who got that this year is Phil Pelletieri, who's your guest, and in part he got it because of the great information he shares about invasive insects when he's on this show.
Perfect. Yeah. Wonderful.
So, so Invasive Species Awareness Month is something that people are welcome to get involved with at local level, and we really would encourage them to do so.
And they can do that, probably just go to the DNR website and learn more?
Yeah, there's actually a website specifically for it at the at invasivespecies.wi.gov. And they can find that. It's actually sponsored by the Governor's Wisconsin Council on Invasive Species.
Perfect. All right. Well, Mary in Wanakee has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Mary. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. It's my pleasure. I wanted to clarify a point that I heard your guest make just a couple of minutes ago. It had to do with a glacier that came in here about 10 to 12,000 years ago, and she indicated that the earthworms moved in at this point, and they were new to the vicinity. One, I'm assuming that new tree species also moved in at the same time, and secondly, when does a species become identified as native if 12,000 years of existence in the same place isn't sufficient?
Actually, I think you said it quite a little bit different from that, Bernie. But
right.
Maybe
right, Mary. I'm not insinuating that that the earthworms that when you start to research the earthworms and you look at their species and you look at their origin, the ones that we have in Wisconsin. They definitely derive from Europe and Asia. And our native earthworms, which, you know, we still could have some in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, they're very small. They don't reproduce as quickly as the invasive ones. And they still can be found in the southern portions of the United States. But here we have yet to encounter them, and there have been numerous researchers that have been trying to find them. We just haven't been able to find them.
So the glaciers killed off this.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And so the regeneration, you know, you're still going to have, you know, seeds that regenerated. It gets into a very dicey. I mean, I've had this conversation with many people. Kelly, you've had this conversation with numerous people. You just really have to go back to the science of it. Not saying that the glacier wiped out everything, but the flush of regrowth that we did have after the glacier occurred without the presence of earthworms. Mm. So it's, you know, there's a lot of research on it. If you want to send me an email at the DNR, I can certainly direct you to a lot of papers on it, and you can research it.
But to answer your second question about how long has something been here to be invasive, the point, invasive doesn't necessarily mean that it's just not native. There are a lot of non-native species that have come from other parts of the world that are not invasive. The vast majority of non-native species that live here are not invasive. If it's come from Europe or Asia, which means it came after after Europeans started colonizing North America, then that's considered to not be native.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks,
Mary. Appreciate your call. And Facebook comment from Becky. I work with friends of the Platte River to battle Japanese hops. Fighting invasive species is a job that sure keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, Becky is an example of a great partner that we have out there in the field. She's doing a lot of research to find out what can we do to control this Japanese hops. This is a plant that's related to the beer hops, mm-hmm. But it's from Japan, and it gets into stream beds. And it's an annual, and so it grows from a seed to growing 20, 30 feet long and then producing seed all in 1 year. And then it dies off in the fall. And so it covers over the banks of streams during the growing season and then dies, leaving those streams exposed to a lot of erosion. So it's really of concern, and it's just starting to get into some of the streams in the Southwest. And it's one that we're hoping that we can keep out of the streams that it's not yet in, but through using some of the research that Becky and others are doing.
Bill wondered if we've actually made any progress on this onslaught of invasives. Are there any that we've actually had some success against? Bernie, you want to comment?
We always have success. Some people, you know, Kelly and I, we work with a lot of people, and we're pretty optimistic, but working with invasives, you can be quite a pessimist. They're very daunting, but it's small things. You know, I always tell people, if you're going to address an invasive, go after the small patch first, and you can succeed in controlling that area. It's the large areas that seem unwieldy and that you'll never get a hold of. But small steps. I always tell people, you know, it's not the end of the world. Buckthorn can be a little overwhelming. Honeysuckle can be overwhelming. Garlic mustard, I see that there's a comment about biocontrol. Hopefully we'll get it within the next year or two. We're definitely trying, but, you know, purple loosestrife is a great example of getting something under control. We definitely have, we're getting it under control. So that's a really positive thing, and it's a biocontrol.
Yeah. And most of the species that are just coming in, as long as it's something that people can find out about when it's first starting, then it definitely is controllable. We have a number of species that we only know of a few populations in the state, and they're being controlled. Mm. Now, giant hogweed is a good example. It's very large plant that it has a toxin in it that burns people's skin, similar to wild parsnip. And we know of a couple populations in the state, and as far as we know, every single population is being controlled, usually by those landowners or by somebody locally.
Perfect. Matt in Madison. Hi to you. Thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. Just wondering if they could answer questions about Phragmites and why DNR apparently introduced it and how to eradicate it.
All right.
Well, that's not true that DNR introduced it.
You did not introduce it.
We definitely did not introduce Phragmites. The Phragmites that seems to be spreading, especially along the Lake Michigan shoreline and into some interior lakes as well, is probably European in nature. Most of it is. We also have native Phragmites as well. And the native Phragmites is becoming much less easy to find. It's not as dense. It's not as robust as the non-native. The non-native was first found in New Jersey, and they think that it probably came in like as a packing material or something like that. And so it's come in from the coast and has kind of moved across the country and come in that way. And Phragmites is a very large, very dense grass that's causing a lot of heartache for people who live on Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
And we have a very large control project underway in some areas of Lake Michigan right now to kind of see, is it something we can actually get a handle on and control if the landowners are willing to follow up on that control and keep it on, you know, keep it from really taking over?
I have some friends who are on Lake, have a second home on Lake Michigan, and their family has made it a point for their kind of portion of the beach, even though they don't really own that portion of the beach. I mean, we're gonna control it on our and do what we can, and it's amazing. It's wide open sand and beautiful, and they're spotted on either side. Phragmites everywhere.
Yeah, that's why it takes everyone to really pitch in and do this.
Yeah, it sure does. Thanks, Mike, Matt, for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, well, we talked about this a little bit, but Scott in Pewaukee had a comment relating to garlic mustard. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Two quick questions. I have quite a bit of problem out here with garlic mustard out in Pewaukee. But I had read that Purdue University was seeking funding to try and attack on a biological level garlic mustard weed, in other words, on a natural level. And I was wondering, number one, if they had found that funding, and number two, from a biological attack standpoint, what exactly would they do? Would they introduce bugs, or would they introduce chemicals, or what would that be?
Okay. Well, it's Purdue might be somewhat involved with this, but it's mostly University of Minnesota, Cornell, and Michigan State right now that are involved with this. And there are a number with a project like this, when there's a weed that's being a problem in North America and we want biological control work on it, we have to find funding, and then we have to work with people in the native habitat of this organism to find out what's feeding on it or what's killing it in that area. And they did that work on garlic mustard they started that about 10 years ago. And they found about four different species of insects that seemed to actually do a pretty good job of killing or at least preventing the flowering of garlic mustard. And they also have done a lot of testing on those insects to find out if they feed on anything else. So they've tested everything that's closely related to garlic mustard. garlic mustard is in the mustard family, and so we have things like canola and other commercial crops that had to be tested. We have a lot of native species that had to be tested. And so all of those have been tested in isolation and with garlic mustard to see, will those insects feed on and reproduce on those other plants. And so that testing has been done both in Switzerland and over here in a containment facility on the University of Minnesota campus. They are still in the process of working on that. They've got one species that they feel like they've done enough research that they feel like it's probably close to being ready for release. They're still getting federal approval now. It goes through a very extensive process for approval. And once it is approved, then they still need to figure out, how do we reproduce these insects sufficiently so we can have lots and lots of bugs to spread around? And that's a big problem. And right now they've got a problem with a parasite on the insects. And so that's yet another little problem that's in the way. So we're probably not going to see those insects being available for release in Wisconsin for at least 2 to 3 years.
I see. So they do have some success, but there's this permutation matrix, if you will, that they have to be sure that what they do introduce doesn't cause more trouble than what we already have.
Absolutely. Right. Correct. Okay. Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Maida in Milwaukee next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I'm really enjoying this program. It's fascinating. I actually wrote a book that was called The City Herbal, and I discussed 34 weeds that grow in cities. And I know you were talking about motherwort. You know, some of these herbs had a very, very long history as herbal medications, and motherwort was one of them and grows all over here, which you know. But what interests me as a New Yorker is the changes I've seen in some of the plants. I see chicory now is all in bloom. Now, chicory you never used to see, at least in New York, and even here, practically July in New York. That and Queen Anne's lace, I always thought of as plants that indicated school was on its way. Because when I was growing up, they didn't start blooming until the end of August. And now, especially Queen Anne's lace, whether it's a global warming or not, they're all over the place. And the other thing that I worry about now is Fuller's teasel, that's everywhere, and thistles are just nonstop. And I'm just wondering, too, now about morels and mushrooms, which a lot of us who seek wild mushrooms have said we don't see any anymore. And I'm wondering if the garlic mustard, you know, the roots secrete a chemical. Is it affecting the trees and the mycorrhiza of the mushrooms? I mean, this whole thing is really just making me very sad.
Yeah, those are all great questions. And let's go with the last one first. We don't know if garlic mustard is impacting morels. I don't think there's been any research specifically on that, but we do know that it is affecting the mycorrhizal fungi of trees. And so garlic mustard can actually slow the growth of trees in the area where it is because the fungi is not able to absorb the nutrients and help the trees grow like it normally would. As far as this other species, well, this year is just way unusual. I mean, 2 years ago was an early spring and warm spring. This year has beat all records, and we now have most things are blooming somewhere between 2 to 3 weeks early. And I think if you look back historically at the data on when Queen Anne's lace or some of these other things were blooming, yes, you're probably seeing that things are moving ahead. And this warm weather, early weather, dry weather are definitely causing things to be blooming early. And what that means for people that are dealing with invasive species is it means that you got to move your calendar as well. If you normally pull garlic mustard in May, you should have been doing it in April this year. If you normally are controlling wild parsnip, you need to get out there and do it now because these things really are way ahead of schedule. Mm-hmm. And certainly a lot of these species are becoming more abundant. The ones that you mentioned are all ones that really like disturbance. And we have a lot more fragmentation, lots more roads, a lot of disturbance out there on the landscape now. And so those are ones that, yes, we're going to see a lot more of them.
And thank you, Maida, for calling. I appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Josie in Sheboygan, turning to you next. Hi, Josie.
Hi, Larry. Good morning. I'm just wondering, if this is an invasive plant. I see it just growing wild in some yards around here. And there's one, a huge one by my garage. It is at least I was going to say 8 feet, but I think it's more like 10 feet, and it has large, like heart-shaped leaves, and it looks like bamboo. Somebody was clearing some of it, and we looked inside of the stem, and it's very woody, and it was hollow.
Bernie?
Well, Josie, that sounds like a Japanese knotweed. We're very familiar with that at the DNR, and unfortunately, this plant is it's making its way across the entire state. It's a very aggressive plant, so if there's any way that you can start controlling it, I would recommend that right now. Take it down next to your garage. It can actually break through your foundation walls. It's a really interesting plant.
It's beautiful. I mean,
it's absolutely beautiful.
I love Queen Anne's lace. Is that harmful?
Queen Anne's lace, I mean, it definitely is invasive, but it's not one of the ones that we would say that, you know, it's end-all, die-all. But particularly with knotweed, the one that you're describing, I would recommend that you remove it immediately. And you're going to have to treat it with an herbicide. It's very aggressive. It can go down, I believe, up to 8 feet, Kelly. It's a plant that we read about all the time. It's interesting because in England, they actually say that they won't give you a mortgage if you have Japanese knotweed on your land because it breaks your foundation. So, again, we're all nodding our heads here. Kelly, Larry, and I remove that plant right away.
Immediately, if not sooner.
Yeah, and it won't be a simple task to remove it. It means keep cutting it back. There will be many stems coming up from the root system, and even if those stems spread into your neighbor's yard, you need to remove every single stem repeatedly in order to kill the root system. It has a very large, extensive root system, and
does it kill trees or?
No, it's going to be shorter than most of the trees, but as Bernie could say, it could break through your foundation if you have it right next to your house. And once it gets into stream systems, it can cause really severe problems along stream corridors where it can completely dominate the stream, the banks. But, getting rid of it, it will take at least 2 to 3 years, no matter what technique you use. But it definitely requires, removing those tops and not letting the root system be fed.
And what's it called again?
Japanese knotweed. A lot of people mistakenly call it Mexican bamboo, but it's actually from Japan and it is a knotweed. It actually is where it's native to is the volcanoes on Japan. It actually gets established on volcanic soils.
Hmm.
That's very interesting. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Listener Mark, let's go to our Facebook page here. Has posted a plant, calling it an invasive, and wondering if you guys can identify the plant from what we have here. Oops, back it up here. Wrong one. What do you think, Bernie?
We think it's purslane. I feel like we're on a talk show or like on a game show. Do you concur, Kelly?
I concur. It's hard to tell for sure. There's a number of plants that it could be, but it looks like it's a purslane. Mm-hmm. Purslane is a common weed in vegetable gardens, in some agricultural fields, and pretty easy to control just by hand pulling. It actually is quite good to eat.
Mm-hmm.
You just pull off the leaves and eat it as a salad.
Oh, they eat the leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay. Well, there you go, Mark. You got salad. You got your dinner salad for you, ready for you right there. Pat in Waukesha, hello to you.
I have a question about Phragmite, which is a term I had never heard. I have a cottage on Lake Michigan, which had a pristine beach, and now we're full of what we call dune grass. Had no idea where it came from. Could that be what you're talking about?
Is it upwards of like 8 to 10 feet tall?
Yes, and it is.
Yeah, forms a dense wall. That's Phragmites, yes.
Could you spell that for me?
Phragmites.
Mites. Phragmites. That's interesting. Apparently nobody on our beach is aware of the fact that you can dig it up because we're all just kind of struggling with it and thinking, oh, isn't that pretty?
Tell me what beach you're on. What part of Door County?
No, I'm on Lake Michigan.
I'm sorry, you're right, yeah.
At Oosburg.
Ousberg. Okay. Well, you guys can all go online, look at the DNR website, and we have a pretty, we have a number of things on there about Phragmites, and you can see what you can do and what you can't do. There are some regulations about what kind of equipment you can take on the beach to control things.
Yes.
Like if you want to go out there with some kind of a riding mower or something, then you need to get a permit to do that. And so, you want to find out what you actually can do before you actually go out there and do and take equipment out on the beach. But there's definitely cutting it, herbicide, careful use of herbicide are all possibility. Hand pulling really is not going to be an option. Those roots are very long and can break off, and then we'll start a new plant.
And we have tried hand pulling just to make a path down to the lake. So I realize how difficult that is. Well, thank you for your information. I'm going to look it up on my iPad.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email from Marcy in Cottage Grove struggling with thistles. Started in the landscape rock and flower beds. They're now spreading into the grass. As much as I pull them out, I think I'm getting by the roots. They keep coming back. Try to get them out before they go to seed, and still they come back. Roundup only kills the plant part, but below ground they survive and keep coming back.
Yeah, she's probably got Canada thistle, which is the only of our thistles. It's the only one that's a perennial with an amazing root system.
Yeah.
And so essentially, just like the knotweed, if you allow any of that root to stay alive under the ground, it will keep popping up. And so you need to get every little shoot when it first comes up. And there are a number of herbicides that do work for it. Unfortunately, they're not all real available for the homeowner. But I would say she should just try some different herbicides if the Roundup isn't working for her.
And Jean lives in Mequon, where teasel is running rampant. She wonders how to get elected officials to recognize this threat or how to get people involved.
Well, teasel is one of the species that's on our restricted list in Wisconsin. So legally, it's something you don't have to get rid of it if it's on your property, but you're not allowed to move it around. And so if, for example, someone is mowing late in the season and they're dragging those seeds back and forth, that's not allowed. And so, first of all, it's just letting the elected officials know about this plant, letting them know it's a problem. Most of it, it's lack of awareness. They just don't know about it. And there are definitely people in Mequon who are familiar with those populations. Yes, they've got kind of the mother of all teasel populations in Mequon. So, yeah, it's a matter of just talking to him, letting him know about it, and letting him know what can be done to control.
And for, again, I think we'll just direct people back to your page because you've got some great information on your website.
Yeah. We do have one other thing that we want to be sure we cover today, and that's that coming up for the July 4th weekend is the landing blitz to let people know about the about aquatic invasive species and how people can avoid spreading them on their boats. And so there's going to be volunteers at boat landings all around the state. There's a couple hundred volunteers that now are out there that will be out there this year to help inform people about what they can do to clean off their boats, to inspect their boats, clean everything off, drain the water, remove plants from their trailers. And there will be conservation wardens out there as well as Lake Association people. There's a Clean Boats, Clean Waters program. And so all these folks will be out there from the weekend before July 4th to the weekend after that July 4th. So hopefully if you're boating, then you'll be able to see some of those folks and have a chance to talk to them.
Oh, wonderful. And then, and your website again is for invasives?
You go on the DNR has a new website.
Yeah.
You know what? We've got to post it on our Facebook page.
Right. Yeah. DNR's website now, you go into it and you just type in the words that you're interested in finding and it'll pop up.
By the way, that new website is really nice. I think it's wonderful. It's very user friendly and a lot of fun to play around with.
It works out pretty well. That search engine really does work pretty well.
And one more thing in regards to Invasive Species Awareness Month, we just want to get the word out on EAB. So right now the population of emerald ash borer in the Chicago area has really expanded and exploded. So there's a lot of declining trees that are coming down. Henceforth, then you get a lot of firewood. So with that firewood, people will be tempted to move it, whether they have lake cottages, second homes. And we just want to stress...
Don't do it.
Don't move your firewood. EAB is, you know, it's encroaching on the state. We are finding new populations. And it's really important that people are aware that, you know, you don't move your firewood and to burn it where you buy it, and definitely keep that in mind. The beetle itself, we talk to a lot of people, and they get it confused with the native tiger beetle.
Yeah.
And we get a lot of calls on EAB. Actually, the native tiger beetle is really aggressive when you pick it up, so it's really active. With the EAB, it's really calm and acts like it's dead. So that's a really easy way to distinguish between the two.
And firewood doesn't just spread emerald ash borer. There are about nine other species of insects, invasive insects, that can also be spread. So it's not just ashwood. It really is all firewood. Shouldn't be spread.
Right.
Good. Be moved around.
Good way to end. Thank you both, Kelly and Bernie. Appreciate it very much. Kelly Kearns and Bernie Williams with the Department of Natural Resources. They deal a lot with invasive species, everything from worms to all those plants out there that create so many problems. And you're probably, as you're, you know, those of us who get out and do a little trout fishing once in a while and get out on the streams, are going to see a lot of those invasive species, unfortunately. But you know what? We're going to go out there anyway to those trout streams. And if you want to know where to go and how to get some catch some trout, you should stay listening, or even if you're not just interested in those fish, I hope you'll stay with us, because Jay Thurston, coming up next, author, educator, longtime trout angler, will be talking with us about Wisconsin trout streams. And he's also got a kid's book out that's called Ring of Fire. We'll talk with him about that as well. Next year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.